Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Getting married for tax reasons. We find out why more older couples are saying I do to protect their wealth. As we await the results of the UK general election, what might tomorrow's politicians do to the UK pension system? And Baroness Ros Altman joins us to debate the financial consequences of quantitative easing. Welcome to The Money Show, the FT's weekly podcast on personal finance and investing. I'm Claire Barrett, FT Money Editor, and I'll be giving you this week's money news in downloadable form. Roses are red, violets are blue, the tax man has said that I must marry you. It's hardly the most romantic of reasons to get married, but more and more older couples are realising the financial advantages of getting hitched. Joining me to explain why is the FT Money writer David Stevenson, who finally married his partner of 20 years last month. David, welcome and congratulations.
Yes, thank you very much. Joyous event.
Well, you say in your piece this week, I'm a raging atheist. I've never seen the point of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
Well, I suppose it was a combination of my accountant. Every time I'd go and see him, he kept going, you know what, David, are you married yet? And I would initially kind of, my hackles would be raised thinking, what business is it here? And then when he bothered to explain it to me, what the implications are, I sort of began to think, maybe he's got a point. And then my next door neighbour, who's also kind of financially aware, kept saying, are you two married yet? And it was just like, oh, just go away. But then when you look into it and you actually begin to understand the consequences, and it's a natural function of time, really. As you get older, you get a little bit wealthier because you've accumulated wealth.
True.
You have kids.
True.
The kids get older. And then when you pop your clogs, for instance, you never like to think about it, but when you get to a certain point, any point really after the mid-40s, you begin to think about these things, you then realise that the tax implications are absolutely horrendous. And then you go through this kind of mental process where you go, well, I'm really opposed to the idea of it, but you know what? It might just be easier just to do it, get married.
Now, of those reasons, the biggest difference between married and non-married couples is likely to be the impact of the new inheritance tax laws. Tell us why.
Okay, so the reality of it is that you can work your way around a lot of the things that cause problems for cohabiting couples, which this idea of common law marriage, which doesn't exist, really. You can sign sorts of agreements and you can make understandings and all that kind of stuff. But the reality of it is, the simple basic reality of it is there's lots and lots of people in the UK now who have a property that is probably worth $500,000, $1 million, $1.5 million. The days when that was unique and special, gone. Lots of people have got that. So at the moment, the limit is £325,000 each for any inheritance IHT. That's the nil rate ban. Now, there is a slight quirk here, which is that last year the government introduced an additional every year over the next, I think it's the next 4 years or 3 years into 2021, that limit, 325 for the house, is going up. But the reality of it is, if you're a single person, it's 325,000. So if you own the property, yeah, for instance, and your property is worth 1 million, and you drop dead tomorrow, then effectively you could face IHT of 1 million minus £325,000. And the other crucial thing is that also if you die without a will, your common law partner doesn't even get necessarily the property, because under the law, a common law partner is not recognised as necessarily the first person it goes to. Now, when you get married, you can do the £325,000 times two. Right,
you both
from the
get that allowance.
Yeah, you already get that £650,000 straight away, and you can transfer that allowance back and forth between married couples. And those in the civil relationship, civil partnership.
And it makes it less complicated when it comes to inheritance. Obviously, if you die without a will, the children would normally have the first claim on your estate rather than the common law partner. So at this point, I'm going to bring in the FT statistician Federica Coco, who has also written about this in FT Money this week. And she's approached the story from a slightly different angle. So Federica, firstly, while marriage rates generally are in decline, the only group of people you found who were going against this trend were, like David, The over 40s.
David is definitely not on his own. I was having a look at statistics on first marriages, so I disregarded widows who were getting remarried or people who had just gone through a divorce and decided to get married again. So I just looked at first marriages, and it used to be that between 2 and 4% of first marriages were people over 40s getting married. And then there was a spike in the mid-90s, both for men and women, and now for men, it's around 12% of first marriages that regard men over 40.
Right.
And for women, it's about 8%. So one reason behind this rise could be, you know, changing economic circumstances, especially for women. They decide to invest more in their career. There are better fertility treatments, so they feel like they can wait. It takes them longer to buy either a house. And people who are wealthier have much higher marriage rates.
Yes, I think that's very, very interesting. You know, clearly the trend is that the more money you have, the more likely you are to think of, you know, the marriage bond.
Yeah, and I found out that 84% of people in the richest quintile are married, and that compares to 40% of people in the poorest quintile.
Wow. And then while David has capitulated by getting married, this isn't going to be the answer for everyone, because cohabitation is by far and away the soar away trend here.
Yeah, I looked at the statistics for the past 20 years and the number of couples that choose to cohabit. This is both same-sex couples and opposite-sex couples have doubled. And by comparison, married couples have increased by, I think it's just over about 10,000 or something like that. They remain fairly stable.
Yeah.
And so people are choosing increasingly to live together rather than get married.
So you think that rather than forcing people to get married in order to gain the protection of these laws, the government should actually turn it on its head?
Yeah, they should just accept that society has changed, and instead what the government has been doing is pushing for policies, tax credits, and they've run campaigns as well to encourage people to get married. The former Prime Minister David Cameron said that it was the safest type of family for children, and yet a higher share of cohabiting couples have children than married couples. And so clearly these things aren't working. These policies aren't pushing people in that direction.
So David, just finally to come back to you, you say in your piece that you feel like a bit of a sellout for having got married. I mean, I think that you've done a sensible and lovely thing personally.
Yes, but the problem is that, you know, that those of us of a kind of slightly more unusual persuasion in terms of religion and attitude towards hierarchy, and also I don't really like the fact that weddings have been turned into an enormous commercial industry.
Well, I'm with you there.
Yeah, and I've got nieces and nephews spending countless tens of thousands of pounds, and it's all good and well saying, oh, but you can't just pop down the registry office and do it like we did, but the social pressure is enormous. And I completely echo what Frederica said, which is, look, the reality of it is there's lots and lots of people who just don't want to have to do this. You know, they don't want to have to go through a whole rigmarole. Why don't you just recognise that they should have the same rights that everybody else does, particularly if they have kids? It just strikes me as logical. And it is something which MPs of all persuasions have been trying to push for many years. And in fact, it's noticeable that various law commissions have basically weighed in on this and said, really, come on, guys, you should do this. It should change this. And virtually every government for the last 10 years has completely ignored their recommendations.
Well, thanks very much there to the FT's Federica Coco and to David Stevenson. You can read their full story, Getting Married for Tax Reasons, now on ft.com/money, or pick up a copy of the FT Weekend newspaper this Saturday. And don't forget, there are still a few tickets left for FT Money's reader event, which is all about inheritance tax. You can meet our star columnist, Merrin Somerset Webb, and ask experts questions, to be held in London on the evening of Monday the 19th of June. Tickets cost £30 and are available now on ft.com/IHT event. Full terms and conditions are online. In the run-up to the election, politicians have been keen to tell us there is no magic money tree to solve the problem of how to fund social care or build more affordable homes. But could more quantitative easing provide the answer? This is one question that Baroness Ros Altman has posed this week in a column she's written for FT Money, examining the effects of the monetary stimulus, and she joins me now on the line. Welcome, Ros.
Hi, Claire. Nice to be here.
It's always lovely to have you on. Now, you've written about QE, a policy that essentially got us out of the financial crisis, thank goodness for that. But you fear that when economic historians look back, they will not view QE very favourably. Why?
Well, I do have some concerns that we don't really know what will happen with this policy. It was designed as an experiment against economic collapse, a sort of emergency measure to artificially lower long-term interest rates by buying government bonds with newly created money in order to boost growth. So we were expecting that that would boost the economy with wealth effects and portfolio balance effects and all kinds of other reflationary elements. However, it has had some pretty negative side effects, and in particular, it has undermined pensions. Pension liabilities have increased significantly because they are measured relative to long-term bond yields, and the lower bond yields go, the more expensive pensions become. Companies are struggling with pension deficits, so in a way, this has been the final nail in the coffin for final salary schemes. But also the policy has distorted investment risk, making asset allocation decisions much more difficult because we don't quite know what has happened to investment risk when the central bank itself has artificially reduced the interest rate on what was supposed to be the risk-free asset that everything else is priced against.
Now, you also believe, as you set out in the piece, that QE has exacerbated inequality. Why is that?
Well, I think it's pretty well documented that inequality will have increased as a result of QE policies. It was, again, originally designed as a temporary policy, but of course the economy has recovered, and we are certainly not in an economic emergency anymore, but QE continues. And that continually has boosted asset prices, which is the aim of the policy. But assets are very unequally distributed across the economy. The top 10% own well over half the assets, and 80% of assets are held by the over 45s. Most average earners or young people will therefore not have benefited as much as the wealthiest, or, for example, on house prices, those who already own their own home will have seen house prices increase significantly. But anyone who doesn't yet have a foot on the housing ladder will have been affected by the rise in rents that is associated with higher house prices. So they will actually have potentially lower disposable income. And if young people have savings, they tend to be in cash. And of course, interest rates on cash accounts and savings accounts have been extremely low, with no offsetting benefit in terms of boosting the price of the asset held because it is just in cash. There is also research recently that suggests, because of the pension impacts of QE, the companies which are trying to fill their pension deficits, which have opened up as a result largely of quantitative easing and the fall in long-term rates, have ended up earning less because employers who are spending money on their deficits are ending up paying lower wages to their workforce than companies who have similar workers but aren't trying to put money into their pension schemes. So some people's wages have been hit by the fallout from quantitative easing. And I just don't think that these impacts have yet been fully understood or fully recognized. And indeed, because it's really still an experiment that hasn't yet ended, we don't quite know all the side effects and how they will play out in the longer run.
Now, finally, you also pose the question of what might happen with QE longer term, and what could be the next stage for policymakers in this great experiment?
So instead of creating new money to finance old borrowing, perhaps the next stage could be to make more effort to use the long-term assets that we currently have to boost growth directly. At the moment, pension funds are being urged to keep buying more bonds, because that is supposed to be lower risk for them than the traditional higher risk assets like equities. But just buying bonds is, in the end, competing with the Bank of England and other central banks that are themselves trying to buy the bonds, which is a vicious circle, pushing long rates down continually lower, while also not directly boosting growth. Whereas if one used the pension assets to fund growth-producing projects that could also provide returns to the pension fund better than bonds, and of course don't forget that many European bonds now have negative interest rates, and one has to ask the question whether they are offering risk-free returns anymore, or are they just return-free risk?
Well, thanks very much there to Baroness Ros Altman. You can read her guest column in FT Money this weekend in the FT Weekend newspaper, or online now at ft.com/money. Finally, you can't have a general election without introducing some pensions tension. Money readers will have noticed that none of the major parties have had much to say at all on the subject of pensions tax relief. So joining me in the studio to discuss now are Josephine Cumbo, our multi-award-winning pensions correspondent, and Tom McPhail, the also award-winning head of retirement policy at Hargreaves Lansdown. Welcome both.
Hello.
Hello.
So I'll kick off by asking you, what are the key pensions issues you'd like to see the next government address?
There's a lot of unfinished business with retirement saving policy. I'd very much like to see the next government, whoever forms the next government, to look at bringing together a joined up coherent savings policy. I think there's a strong argument for a savings commission, something to act as a focal point to examine the question of why we're not saving more for retirement and how we can better achieve that goal of helping millions of people to save and invest for the long term and ultimately to build up decent retirement pots.
And Jo, that's a view you broadly share.
Yes, I agree with Tom on all of those points. But for me, the biggest pension issue has to be getting people to save adequately for retirement. We have millions of people who have been brought into workplace pension saving in recent years, which is all great news. But they really need to save five times more than they are now. And that's a big challenge. So getting pensions saving levels up to an adequate level has to be a priority for the new government going forward. And Tom, now you've been thinking and working about pensions for a long time now. I'm really interested to know what role you think pensions tax relief could play in dealing with some of the issues that you've raised.
My principal concern around pension tax relief is that it costs the government a huge amount of money, £48 billion a year, more than they spend on defence. There's a big chunk of the annual budget allocated to pensions. It's inefficient, it's poorly allocated, it's poorly understood. Most people don't even understand the benefit of the tax relief they get from the Treasury. So the Treasury is spending this money, no one recognises that. So the whole system is ripe for reform. It's riddled with inconsistencies and complexities that challenge and obstruct people who want to save for retirement. I would love to see the government really revisit the work they did on rethinking how tax relief is delivered to look at a simpler, more effective system, more that encourage people to put money aside for their retirement. But the problem we have is that the default setting for the Treasury at the moment is the simple answer, is just to kind of salami slice away at allowances. And I think the challenge is to try and find a way through all of that and to give them a system that would address those challenges I've
touched
on.
And just in terms of what you think might be a good reform, would that be switching to a flat rate of relief? Currently there's high rate relief and basic rate.
I think there's two areas to look at. One is the concern around how much of the money is channeled into final salary pension schemes. The Treasury is fire hosing money, huge quantities of money into final salary schemes, really to the detriment of the millions of people who are now building up retirement savings pots in personal pensions and defined contribution pensions. So that needs revisiting. And then specifically to your question, Joe, on the tax relief, one solution would be to go to a flat rate, a very simple message of for every £3 you put in, we, the government, will put in £1. As an incentive, that would be far more effective. But there are more radical alternatives. You could weight the system in favour of younger savers. You could say the younger you are, the more of a top-up you get from the government. So you could come up with an age-related system. However you do it, it has to be simple and it has to be fair.
And it has to appeal to the voters. I guess that was one of the issues that perhaps prevented the previous Conservative government from making any major changes to pensions. Now, the Labour and Conservative manifestos, as Claire mentioned, were silent on pensions tax relief. Should listeners take away from this that there won't be any major changes in the new Parliament?
The Liberal Democrats, to their credit, specifically flagged up that they wanted to see a reform of pension taxation. I think it's unlikely they will be forming the next majority government, but you know, the fact that it is there as a political issue, I think, is still a very good thing. In answer to your question, just because they didn't specifically address it in their manifestos doesn't mean it won't be on the agenda. But I think the concern is that their default setting will be this salami slicing approach. Mm. And we know how much this upsets people. Investors hate it when their allowances keep getting cut and more restrictions are brought in.
Just talk us through the salami slicing, as you say. It's a great phrase. What have we seen in recent years?
Progressive cuts to the lifetime allowance, the amount of tax-free pension pot you can build up. It's gone from £1.8 million down to £1 million. The annual allowance, which at one point was as high as £255,000, frankly, a bit generous, has come down to 50,000, then to 40,000. We've had the tapered annual allowance that targets higher earners. We've had
particularly hated by money readers.
We've had the money purchase annual allowance, which is a real problem for people in their 50s and 60s who might come out of the workforce, dip into their pension pots, and then look to save again in the future. The Treasury's looked at cutting that money purchase annual allowance from 10,000 a year down to 4,000 a year. It's just constantly chipping away and bringing further complexity into the system. And as you say, Claire, people hate it.
Just in terms of the lifetime allowance, it's 1 million. Some people might think that sounds like quite a generous amount, but it's actually hitting middle England in some ways, isn't it? You've got head teachers on high salaries who've been long serving, etc. So how much further of that salami slicing could we see, do you think, is likely without having the effect of damaging saving going forward?
I think we've hit that limit already. I think we, from the correspondence and the phone calls we get at Hargreaves Lansdown, as you say, your readers here at the FT, we already know people are really fed up with the fact that their allowances are being cut back. I think you can always cut the lifetime allowance more. You can always cut the annual allowance more. But we're really eating into people's commitment to saving and their willingness to engage with the system. And I think the Treasury is at risk of doing real damage already in how far they've gone. And this, again, is why I think there is an imperative to try and find a way through this, to try and come up with a radical solution, if not a once and for all, at least something that takes us beyond this salami slicing into some clear water on the other side.
All right, we don't have a crystal ball, so we can't see exactly what's going to happen in the future just now. But if it's anything to if past performance is anything to go by, previous interruptions by the Chancellor and into pension policy have created more problems, arguably, than they've solved. Thank you very much for joining us, Tom.
And we await with bated breath the results of the budgets after the election. Goodness me, I'm sure we'll get you both back in the studio to discuss whatever happens. That's all from the Money Show this week. If you've got a story that you'd like us to follow up or a question to pose to our team of financial experts, get in touch. Email us money@ft.com, tweet us @ftmoney, or comment on our articles online at ft.com/money. We'll be back next Thursday at the usual time. Goodbye.